From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. When House Speaker Jim Wright gave reporter John Berry permission to follow his day-to-day activities, little did Berry realize he'd be documenting Wright's fall from power. On this edition of Fresh Air, John Berry talks about power in Washington and how one man fell. It's also the subject of his new book, The Ambition and the Power. Also today, we meet police artist Douglas P. Hinkle. With pens, pencils, and patient questioning, Hinkle helps crime victims remember whodunit. Rock critic Ken Tucker explains why college radio, once daring, now sounds so predictable. And critic Laurie Stone checks out the comedy of Richard Lewis. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev assured Lithuanians today that they would have a say in their republic's future, but he cautioned that a confrontation with Moscow could lead to tragedy. An estimated 300,000 Lithuanians held a silent protest today during Gorbachev's visit to the Baltic Republic. Gorbachev said he has ordered that a new law be written to establish a way to secede from the Soviet Union. Gorbachev is in Lithuania for 3 days for meetings to try to reverse the Lithuanian Communist Party's break with the National Party. After weeks of often divisive debate, the Yugoslavian Communist Party has finally given its approval to free and open elections. Pierre Vickery reports the decision complements the economic reforms already put into effect by the government.
The Yugoslav Communist Party has agreed to give up its monopoly of power and to hold free national elections as early as April. The Central Committee announced at a meeting in Belgrade that party leaders in all six of Yugoslavia's republics had given their approval. Until now, only the northern republics of Slovenia and Croatia were committed to a multi-party system, with elections planned in March. Once the decision is endorsed at a special party congress next week, it's likely that local multi-party elections will also be announced in the south. The congress delegates are also expected to give their approval for Yugoslavia to become a full participant in the Western economy. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
President Bush has welcomed the lifting of martial law in China as a very positive move, despite congressional criticism that it is a meaningless gesture by Beijing. Details from NPR's Brian Naylor.
President Bush told reporters this morning Beijing's action yesterday was a move in the right direction.
I view the lifting of martial law as a very sound step. For those that are interested in human rights and the reform that was on the move and that we'd all like to see go forward, there's no way you can look at that but not say it is very positive.
Most observers say the action by the Beijing government is a largely cosmetic one, designed to soften criticism of China by foreign governments. Army troops have been replaced by reinforced police in Beijing, and there are still strict limits on political expression. While not indicating what further steps he might pursue in U.S.-Chinese relations, the president said he does not want to isolate China, and in his words, set the clock back. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 10 points today to close at 2760.67. Advances led declines 8-5, volume 154 million shares. The average price of a share gained 12 cents. This is NPR News. Supermarkets around the nation today shut down mist machines designed to keep fruits and vegetables looking fresh after one such device was linked to Legionnaire's disease outbreak that killed two people. Late last year, about 70 people in Bogalusa, Louisiana, developed symptoms of Legionnaire's disease. 30 cases were confirmed in the laboratory. Two of the victims died. At least four national supermarket chains, Winn-Dixie, Safeway, A&P, and Kroger, switched off their vegetable mist machines. Chicago's Board of Ethics accepted the resignation of its new executive director today after learning that he failed to tell the panel he was involved in an ethics probe in Louisiana. Cheryl Corley of member station WBEZ reports.
It was just a month ago that Gary O'Neill was hired to run Chicago's Ethics Commission. After a two-hour closed-door meeting with the Ethics Board, he resigned today. O'Neill was one of 21 people allegedly involved in funneling insurance company funds to the campaign of a candidate for Louisiana State Insurance Commissioner. The Chicago Board did not learn that until yesterday. O'Neill did not tell board members during his interview because he says he believed the matter had been resolved.
The ethics complaint that was filed in Louisiana had to do with events in 1986 and 1987, and the complaint, there's never been any finding of civil or criminal wrongdoing.
Even so, one Chicago official says the hiring of O'Neill for an ethics job while an ethics issue was not resolved makes the city a laughingstock. For National Public Radio, I'm Cheryl Corley in Chicago.
The United States said today the troops outside the Peruvian ambassador's residence in Panama City are mostly members of Panama's public forces with only a few U.S. troops, and said Peru should direct its complaint to the Panamanian government. Peru had protested to Washington Tuesday over the presence of American forces around the envoy's home. A member of deposed government of General Manuel Noriega is believed to be hiding inside. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson. Terry Gross is on her midwinter vacation. In 1987, Jim Wright became Speaker of the House. He built the speakership into one of the most powerful positions in the government. The controversial Wright became the target of an ethics investigation by a House committee. He resigned the speakership in May of 1989. The story of Wright's rise and sudden dramatic fall is the tale of power in Washington. My guest, John Berry, has written that story in his new book, The Ambition and the Power. During Wright's final 2 years in politics, John Berry was at his side. When Berry began his book, Wright granted him permission to attend virtually all of his meetings where his staff was present. He also was able to attend many other private and confidential meetings as time went by. This access gave Berry a rare inside view of the workings of the Congress. Berry also conducted hundreds of other interviews for the book. John Berry is the former Washington editor for Dunn's Business Month. He's written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, and Esquire. I asked him how he was able to get that degree of privileged access to Jim Wright.
Well, the book grew out of a profile I wrote for the New York Times Sunday Magazine. And as soon as I did that profile, as soon as I met Wright, it became apparent to me that Wright was a very different animal, that his view of the speakership was totally different from his recent predecessors. He wanted to make it into an office almost equal to the presidency in power. I thought, and I know power is a zero-sum game, if Wright was going to have more, then somebody else was going to have less, and they were not going to yield power gracefully. So I thought it would be a good book. I asked Wright if he'd cooperate. What I really wanted was an hour of exclusive interview time a week, something like that. I asked him for access to private meetings. His staff objected, but to my amazement, he agreed. He said he didn't have the time to give me any exclusive interviews, but the access wouldn't be a problem. Why did he agree? I appealed to his sense of history. I think his decision also reflected a little bit of hubris on his part. And I think although he generally dislikes the press, it was some chemistry on our part between I used to be a football coach, and his first ambition in life was to coach football. And I think that's really a major reason as to why he agreed. And I want to add that he had no editorial control, did not read the manuscript before it was published, of course had no financial stake in it. And other members of Congress also cooperated with me and allowed them into private meetings. Newt Gingrich was, you know, extraordinarily candid with me during the 100th Congress as to what he was doing. So I was going back and forth, too. It wasn't just Wright who cooperated.
Politicians often get fascinated with the idea of being judged by history. I mean, Richard Nixon kept tapes in part because he wanted history to record what it was he'd been up to. Jim Wright let you in part because he was feeling historical. What goes on in a politician's mind? I mean, somehow I think it's dangerous when a politician begins viewing themselves in terms of a larger history.
I agree with you. I remember when Nixon was elected, I didn't think much of him, but I thought the nation could survive some petty crookery maybe. But what was dangerous was exactly what you said. These people want to do large things. And Wright, you know, there is hubris there. And I think what destroyed Wright was his hubris. It wasn't, this is not a tale of morality. It's a tale of power.
The staff didn't want you to participate in these meetings, didn't want you to be there. What was their fear?
Well, just the fear of, you know, they just didn't want a reporter on the inside when they didn't have any control over them. They just, you know, they felt that there were a lot of things that happen on the insides that should not be known on the outside. I mean, years ago, I mean, a century ago, Bismarck said, you know, you don't want to know how either sausages or laws are made. And, you know, this explains how sausages and laws are made.
I would think that after you spend a couple of years covering somebody that closely, that there might be tenuous threads of friendship that would develop. Did you ever find this a threat?
Well, you know, I do like Wright, and I have a lot of respect for him. I think a closeness did develop, frankly. I'll be honest about that. I don't think the book's an apologia for Wright, and I think the clearest evidence that it's not an apologia is that Newt Gingrich has publicly praised the book and even given me a quote to use in advertising it. So I think that's a pretty clear statement that I managed to retain my objectivity. I mean, I always knew that would be a problem that I had to be very careful of.
My guest is John Berry. His book, The Ambition and the Power, details Jim Wright's rise and fall in Congress. Jim Wright granted John Berry unprecedented access to attend virtually every private meeting in which he participated. One of the most startling episodes I remember from about 1987 was when Jim Wright was invited by the White House to participate in trying to bring about peace in Nicaragua. And Jim Wright sensed that there was perhaps a trap in the White House, but I also think he sensed that there was a power vacuum because the president at that time was at best inattentive.
Exactly. The liberals in the Democratic caucus initially fought his decision to go forward and join with the White House in that because they all foresaw the trap. In fact, in one of the meetings, Trent Lott, the number two Republican in the House from Mississippi, now in the Senate, blurted out, well, if that happens, the trap will have trapped us. Clearly the Republicans...
The trap being, I wonder if you could explain it.
Being a joint peace initiative by Wright and Reagan. I think Wright not only felt that there was a vacuum in the White House, but that a peace initiative at that particular time had a good chance to succeed. That was the only reason that I think, or at least the driving reason behind his decision to go forward. The liberals so opposed his initiative that he was, if it hadn't worked, I think he was risking his speakership right then. What they feared was that the peace initiative would collapse. As a result, the White House would turn around and say, look, we tried a diplomatic initiative. The Speaker of the House was with it, but it didn't work. Now give us more contra-aid. That was the fear of the liberals. And Wright, however, was in personal contact and had known for years people like Oscar Arias, the president of Costa Rica, Duarte, the president of El Salvador, Sergio Ramirez, the vice president of Nicaragua. And he talked to all those people, and he sensed a possibility of something happening. The White House had no idea that possibility existed. I think if they had, they probably would not have proceeded with the initiative. And, of course, Wright was proved correct.
Part of this, then, was that the conservatives also feared that if it succeeded, Wright would have far more power to put through the progressive agenda that people such as Newt Gingrich opposed. And was this at the point that Newt Gingrich decided to take on Wright as being a corrupt and an abusive man?
Actually, Gingrich had decided several months even before that to take him on. And again, it's a tale of power. It's not a tale of morality. In April 87, that's when Gingrich decided to begin his ethics campaign against Jim Wright. He said to me about that time that it's clear if Wright ever consolidates his power, he'll be a very formidable man. We've got to take him on early to prevent that. That was right after Wright had passed a budget through the House without a single Republican vote, which was quite unusual. Now, a few years earlier, Gingrich had called Tip O'Neill corrupt and had vowed to drive O'Neill from office, but he had abandoned that campaign because he was isolated. And the reason he was isolated was that the Republicans liked Tip O'Neill personally. Wright was different because of the way Wright used power. He was making the Republicans entirely irrelevant and making a lot of enemies.
You quote Newt Gingrich as saying that in politics, it's just very hard to have a personal relationship. It probably attracts those who, in part, get their ego needs from a larger audience because they're too frightened to get it from a smaller audience. Would you say this is true of politicians that you've met and spent? And what goes on that makes them fear the kind of smaller audience?
They all have driving egos. You know, that's a very interesting question. Most politicians appear to be extroverts, but I think very few of them are. In fact, I can remember having dinner once with a couple of members of the Congress, of both Republicans and Democrats, and we were talking about that, and one of them said that he didn't think there was a single extrovert, it was a Republican, on his side of the aisle. They were all introverts. And Les Aspin, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, said, yeah, I think an extrovert is a person who will sit down next to you on an airplane and start talking. Don't you hate that, he said. They're very much into themselves. They need those egos to survive in the game. It's a very rough game. They take a lot of criticism. I think a lot of them are flawed psychologically. But if they were less flawed, they'd be less ambitious and less driven. And all the success, I think that's true of most very successful people in all walks of life. They are driven people. And that's because there's something there that leaves them unsatisfied.
You set up a parallel between Jim Wright and Thomas Foley, now Speaker of the House. Mm-hmm. Very different sets of drives. Thomas Foley seems not the driven man that Jim Wright was. Yet Thomas Foley has risen and has a great deal of power and respect now. Could you explore that dynamic a little bit and those differences?
They're about 180 degrees mm-hmm. opposite. Mm-hmm. Wright, I've been in Washington a dozen years covering politics, and Wright was probably the most ambitious politician I've ever met. This is not to say that he didn't have ideals. Foley is very laid back, not only in style, but I don't think he has an agenda the way that Wright had an agenda. Wright really took office as Speaker knowing exactly what he wanted to do. Foley was never an empire builder. I think he was more intellectually challenged by being in the leadership. I think that's why before he became the House Whip back in 1981, he was chairman of the Agriculture Committee. And it's very unusual for a chairman to give up a post to be even the majority leader, the number two slot, much less the number three slot. Someone like a John Dingell or Dan Rostenkowski would have built an empire out of the Agriculture Committee. They would have, it gets into the securities markets through the trading of commodities. It gets into international politics through agricultural exports. And there was a lot of potential there to build an empire, but Foley didn't do that. Instead, he liked the intellectual challenge of dealing with a lot of other issues.
It seems almost a Zen approach to power. Compared to Jim Wright, by not seeking it, he now has it.
Yeah, I think that's true. He's got a greater sense of pace, probably, than anybody at his level in politics. By the same token, he has yet to show that he's got the kind of leadership ability that Wright had. Whether you despise Wright or revere him, the guy had guts. He had the courage to go out there on his own and to make waves.
You quote somebody in the book as saying, I think it's George Miller, the congressman, the Democrat from California, is saying, we have a little machine here that if you stick your head up too far...
Hedge clipping service.
Come along and slice it off.
That's exactly right, and that's in the prologue. Interestingly, Miller and Foley had a little run-in that might sort of exemplify the difference between Wright and Foley. There was a dramatic vote on the House floor, and Wright was trailing, ended up winning it by one vote. And Miller, who had earlier in the day told Wright, I'm not going to let you down, Mr. Speaker, walked in to the House chamber in an emotional state and for a reason entirely unrelated to the bill, anger at Wright over something else, voted no and stormed off the floor. Foley went after him and caught him at the elevator outside the House chamber and said to George, "George, we're going to lose this thing." And Miller said to him, "Don't come near to me, Tom. I'm mad as hell." And Foley said, "Well, I just thought you'd voted by mistake." And Foley watched Miller take the elevator and leave the floor. And again, it led to a very dramatic moment on the House floor. But I don't think Wright would have let Miller just walk away like that. Neither would Tony Coelho, the House whip, nor would a lot of others. But Foley didn't feel it was his preserve, or I don't know if that's the right word, but to try to drag Foley back onto the floor. I mean, to drag Miller back onto the floor. Or even really to try to convince him to reverse his vote. He just let him go.
My guest is writer John Berry. His book is The Ambition and the Power, and it tells the story of Jim Wright and his rise and fall in power and the power in Washington, D.C. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is John Berry. His new book, The Ambition and the Power, tells the story of how Jim Wright rose to power in the Congress and the forces that led to his fall, and in part describes the larger power structure in the House of Representatives. It struck me that there were a lot of unspoken rules of behavior in the House that sometimes could function like tripwires.
Right.
I wonder if you could explain what some of these were.
Well, Wright violated a few of them, which I think is why he's not Speaker right now. One is, and maybe the most important, is that the members of Congress believe that the leadership is there to serve them. They are a constituency, just as the district is the constituency for the member. And when they want a favor, whether it's help raising money or something as small as being allowed to use a vacant office down the hallway to store a laser printer, they expect the leadership, meaning the Speaker, to perform that service for him. And that, for example, would require Wright or any speaker to be on the floor of the House or in the cloakroom where he's accessible to the members. Tip O'Neill lived on the floor and in the cloakroom. Everybody knew where they could find him. Wright did not. And the reason was Wright had his own agenda. Tip O'Neill believed in the saying that the president proposes, Congress disposes. Wright did not believe in that saying. In fact, quoting it to him used to really annoy him. So Wright didn't have time to spend on the floor of the House dealing with other members' issues, and because he needed to use that time to push his own agenda. But, you know, there's an interaction between the two. If you're not serving them, then they're not going to vote for you. They're not going to give you their vote. And Wright never struck that proper balance. I asked him about that once because I knew Tip had spent so much time there, and he said to me, "Well, I'd like to schedule more time for the floor." But the very idea of scheduling time to be on the floor would have been foreign to Tip O'Neill. That's where all his power comes from. And I think Wright, again, lost sense of that. Another one is in the way you use parliamentary procedure. Wright was very, very rough in the way he did that. And you can make a strong case, the Republicans would certainly argue, that he abused his power in that regard. The vote we were talking about a few moments ago, said a dramatic vote, that occurred in October 87. And Wright had lost a vote at noontime. At 3 o'clock, it was on a tax bill, right after the stock market collapsed during the budget summit talks. House rules prohibited him from bringing the bill back for another vote the same day. So he adjourned the House at 3 o'clock and reconvened it at 3:15. Technically, this created a new legislative day and allowed him to bring it back for a second vote, which he barely won, 206-205. But it clearly violated the spirit of the rules of the House.
And a lot of the members must have certainly felt
They were
duped. Well,
the Republicans were absolutely outraged. Dick Cheney, now Secretary of Defense, said at the time, he called Wright a heavy-handed son of a bitch, that he taught us that Republican votes don't count as much as Democratic votes. Now, that feeling is what allowed Gingrich to go forward. I think, in a way, Wright's speakership, you know, to say it was doomed would be a little bit too strong, but it really, you know, passed a major test at that point in time. And after that, Republicans, whenever Newt said something vicious against Wright, they cheered him on instead of isolating him. It was a very important moment.
I was struck by a number of anecdotes in your book that led me to believe that these politicians carry grudges for very long times. They've got long memories about small slights and larger ones, and that affects their judgment and how they work.
Absolutely. You know, it's a very personal place. There was whether it's the assignment of something as small as a parking space can affect a vote, you know, years later.
You noticed a demarcation between congressmen who were elected in before 1974 and those after. What is the nature of that demarcation? How does that affect the power structure of the House?
Well, of course, the 74 election was the post-Watergate election. Democrats gained 49 seats in the House. Many of them were from marginal districts or even outright Republican districts. And the Republicans expected to get those seats back, and they haven't. And I think that's why the Democrats continue to control the House.
Has it made for a more contentious group of congressmen?
Well, what it really did, I think, was made these people from largely Republican or mixed districts more cautious. And, you know, plus they were generally not party hacks that came in. It wasn't only the 74 election, but that's the single biggest group. There were very, most of those people were outside the political process and ran for the Congress for the first time and won. So they didn't owe anything to the Democratic Party. That's one of the reasons that Wright ran into trouble, because he was putting forward a complete, comprehensive agenda. But Wright's real problems were less ideological ones, at least on the Democratic side, than some of the ways he used procedures.
Did Jim Wright ever admit to you that maybe he went too far?
Oh, yes. Yeah, he said that publicly now, but it's a little bit late.
What has been his reaction to your book?
Well, he dislikes, I guess it's the bulk of the book, really, which details how power is used, because that does portray him as not power-hungry and ruthless, although I think he was doing it not for megalomaniacal reasons, but to push through his agenda. But he's obviously very happy that it says he's not a thief, in effect, and pretty much all the reviewers have been convinced by the evidence in there.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming and being on the Fresh Air with us today.
Well, thanks a lot. I enjoyed it.
John Berry's new book is The Ambition and the Power, The Fall of Jim Wright, A True Story of Washington. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be Ted Morgan. He covered the trial of fugitive war criminal Klaus Barbie for the New York Times Magazine. The story of Barbie and the German occupation of France is a personal story for Morgan, who fled France as a child during that war. Morgan's new book is An Uncertain Hour, The French, the Germans, the Jews, and the Klaus Barbie Trial and the City of Lyon. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
from Philadelphia. I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. Sometimes police catch criminals with computers, telecommunication systems, and multi-million dollar laboratories. But with all the high-tech devices, police still have need for the talents of artists like Douglas Hinkle. He uses victims' descriptions to come up with portraits of criminals. Coming up, we meet Douglas Hinkle. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker tells us what's right and what's stinko with college radio. And critic Laurie Stone tells us what she thinks of stand-up comic and now TV star Richard Lewis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Soviet leader Gorbachev warned citizens of Lithuania today that their demands for independence could lead to severe economic hardships and also threaten the future of his political and economic reforms. The Soviet leader arrived today in Vilnius for a three-day visit, prompted by a growing uneasiness there. Ann Cooper has more on the story.
Gorbachev spent the day lecturing groups of factory workers and other Lithuanian residents on the issue of independence. His goal was clear. By promising to give Lithuania and other republics more political autonomy, he hoped to dispel some of the independence fervor. At the same time, Communist Party leaders sent a new signal that Moscow might not interfere if Lithuanians continue their drive to leave the Soviet Union. The government newspaper Izvestia reported tonight that another Politburo member told Lithuanians they do have the right to hold a referendum on the question of seceding from the Soviet Union. Izvestia said the government has drafted a new law spelling out the mechanism for secession, but it gave no further details. For National Public Radio, I'm Ann Cooper in Vilnius.
A police airplane with five people on board, including two officials of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, is missing on a flight from northern Chile to Santiago. The U.S. officials arrived in Chile over the weekend to look into security measures taken by officials in handling fruit for export to the U.S. In El Salvador's civil war, guerrillas have called for U.N.-mediated talks with the government of President Alfredo Cristiani, while the legislature in the country prolongs a stage of siege for another month. From San Salvador, Joyce Hackle reports.
2 months after launching the biggest military offensive of their decade-long civil war, Salvadoran rebels have offered to meet with the government at a UN-supervised meeting to be held within the next 30 days. Meanwhile, Cristiani announced plans to travel to the United States and meet with UN General Secretary Javier Perez de Cuellar next week, bolstering speculation that the United Nations could step in to mediate before rebels renew their military offensive. The proposed negotiations could forestall a second wave of guerrilla attacks, which U.S. and Salvadoran officials had predicted would begin in mid-January. The guerrillas also called on the government to lift the state of siege, which the Salvadoran legislature voted yesterday to prolong for another 30 days. For National Public Radio, this is Joyce Hackle in San Salvador.
In Washington, the U.S. Agriculture Department said today that farmers have planted about 57 million acres of winter wheat for harvest this year, up 3% from last year. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 10 points to close at 2,760.67 in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker's been out of college for quite a while now, and he was curious about what music's being played over college radio stations, so he took a look at Billboard's list of top college hits and decided to listen to them.
College radio really took off as a subdivision of pop music programming about 10 years ago, when it was just about the only place you could hear punk and post-punk music. These days, college radio still makes a lot of noise about being an adventurous alternative to commercial rock radio, but in many ways it's as ossified as any station that plays Led Zeppelin and Genesis all the time. College radio is still dominated by English rock, British acts that are reasonably obscure to the general listener. It's easy to hear why a band such as The Wonder Stuff, very hot stuff on college radio right now, doesn't get much airplay anywhere else. That's The Wonder Stuff and Don't Let Me Down Gently, typically turgid material that's made the group a valued commodity on college radio. To be sure, there's better, harder stuff to be heard. The Jesus and Mary Chain, an act formed by the Scottish brothers William and Jim Reid, has just released an album called Automatic, and one good song from it, Blues from a Gun, is currently the most played song on college radio stations throughout the country. Jesus and Mary Chain has taken various aspects of punk rock, the loud, distorted volume, the surly attitude, and updated them for the 90s. Some college radio acts move in the opposite direction, opting for more chipper melodies and a winsome, even playful attitude. The best example of this is the music of The Mighty Lemon Drops. Heartbreak Thing is from the Mighty Lemon Drops' new album called Laughter. The group's jocular name and album title are a very conscious reaction to the gloomy, mopey music that dominates college radio. The cliche is that to get played on college radio, you have to sing in a monotone about depression, despair, or even better, suicide. A popular act like Ministry, for example, is the rock version of a bad Sylvia Plath impersonation. College Kids of America, you must be kidding. In general, college playlists are as rigidly formatted as your average hard rock, country, or adult contemporary station. College stations are supposed to be adventurous, but they'd rather die than play anything more than a smattering of rap music, or even the best commercial rock, like Tom Petty's Full Moon Fever album. That would be considered square, I suppose. Like every other radio format, college radio showcases some good music, but it would be a lot better if it outgrew its pretensions and prejudices and played all kinds of music, not just undergraduate melodrama.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for The Village Voice, LA Weekly, and Spin. Here's some more music from Jesus and Mary Chain's Automatic. Here comes Alice.
Here she comes, on that street. She's got something you would love to meet. It's a heart, and a heart is black. Think
This is Fresh Air. Douglas Hinkle was a middle-aged college professor of Romance languages and literature when he shifted to police work. He's walked a beat and ridden in a patrol car, but his specialty is forensic art. An account of his police work is described in his new book called Faces of Crime. Armed with pencils, sketch pads, and plenty of erasers, he spent hours listening to witnesses or victims of crime while he draws. He shuns computers and composite books and relies on the basic tools of the sketch artist. The movies and TV cop shows often portray the police sketch as the key to solving a crime. I asked Douglas Hinkle if this, in fact, is what goes on down at the station.
What much more frequently happens is that the drawing in the first place is not accurate because the description is not accurate, and then it gets pinned to the bulletin board and eventually gets covered up with thank you notes and things of that nature, you know.
Why wouldn't a description be accurate? What would go on for a witness at the that he or she couldn't remember what had happened?
Well, first of all, a victim of violence, if the witness happens to be the victim and not a passerby or some other person, he is likely to be traumatized for a wide variety of reasons. And in the meantime, what happens to your vision is that you look at the point of threat. Consequently, you're not looking at the face. It is just an indistinct blur. Then the policeman asks you to describe it, and you say, well, gee whiz, he had an average face, you know. Well, what's an average face? So sometimes this is very, very frustrating for the investigator because he has to spend a lot of time very patiently seeking out details until he gets a description that's worthwhile using. And in many cases, it's just simply not worthwhile using.
So say somebody comes to you and has been the victim of a holdup in the street and can give you a precise identification of, say, the kind of weapon that was used, but gets then fuzzy sort of on the description. How do you draw this person out to try to recall the detail?
What I generally do is to try to spend some time talking with the victim, calming him or her down, getting to know something about the particular individual, getting them to talk about subjects that are close to their heart, their children, the local school, whatever it happens to be, their pets. And when they have calmed down sufficiently, I start in a very structured system of questions which are intended to elicit a description. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. What I try to do is to work from the general to the specific. I'll start with the shape of the head, and I'll give them a chart of a dozen or so head shapes to take a look at and study, and ask them simply to tell me which one reminds them most closely of the shape of the head and face of the offender. Once I have that down, and this doesn't happen instantaneously, once that has happened, once I've got it down, I will then go to other generalities, usually having to do with what I call the negative spaces on the face. That is, the distances between features.
For instance, the eyes, how far apart they are?
Precisely, yes. I generally identify five major negative spaces. The space from the hairline to the eyebrows, which is the least reliable of all because of hairdos, what have you, unless it's completely visible. Then the space between the eyes, whether they are narrow, set close together, whether they're wide set, or whether they're more or less average. Then the space across the cheekbones, from the outside of one cheekbone to the outside of the other. In some people, this is quite broad, and when it is, it does tend to distort your perception of the distance between the eyes. Then, most important, perhaps, is that distance between the bottom of the nose and the top of the upper lip. We don't think of this as being particularly important, but if you don't get it right, you mess up your description altogether. I'll give you an example. Let's take President Reagan. He has Celtic heritage, and this distance is quite large. When he was running against Fritz Mondale, we noticed that Mr. Mondale's distance in there was quite short. What the cartoonists will do is to exaggerate each. They will show President Reagan with a distance that takes up most of his face between his nose and his upper lip. And with Mr. Mondale, we'll scrunch them up together to give him a nutcracker face.
This is great for identifying through caricature somebody quickly at a glance. How accurate are the descriptions that a witness would give to you of this identifying space from nose to lip?
Not very, unless you take it out of them by gradual questioning. Sometimes I'll have to do three or four side sketches on a separate piece of paper and ask them to help me adjust that distance until we get it right.
Sometimes I'm really startled to see the artist's conception of what a perpetrator looks like versus the against the photograph of the person once caught. And I think, how did anybody make the jump from the drawing to the real person?
Sometimes it's extremely difficult. On the other hand, sometimes it comes very easily. It depends on circumstances. I was riding patrol one night when we got a call of an... I was at home when I got a call that there had been an assault up at the police station. When I got there, I found it that it was a murder. A young student had been walking by the courthouse when he was stabbed in the throat by a local tough who was trying to pick a fight. The boy bled to death very quickly. About 30 feet away, there was standing a very level-headed young graduate student who'd had a few beers, but he was still sober. And he said, "I think I can help you. I saw the whole thing go down." So he sat down, gave me a description. It took about an hour, hour and a half to put the thing on paper. I showed it to the chief of detectives and said, "Oh, I know him." He said, "This is John Salyers. Let's go get him." They actually got the guy within 2 to 3 hours after the murder, and the resemblance was almost photographic.
What's the most effective technique you've seen somebody use to disguise themselves, to sort of frustrate the artist's conception?
One of the cleverest I've run across involved the use of an orange Band-Aid beside the nose. It was in a bank holdup. Every teller in the place noticed the orange Band-Aid and wanted to describe it in great detail. The robber just simply tossed it onto the street as he sprinted down out the bank door, and it was found just a few yards from his exit. But it served as well as a ski mask would have served. In that particular instance.
Was the robber ever caught?
Yes, he was caught, as a matter of fact.
But the...
But that had nothing to do with the drawing.
So if somebody wanted to change their hair color or grow a beard or shave a mustache, these things would not be that effective in disguising someone? I mean, these...
Oftentimes not. Now, one of the things that I do... as a public service, as a matter of fact, I train bank tellers in the area I happen to live. And one of the things I point out to them through a series of slides is that you can train yourself to look through facial hair and see what's underneath. And some of those slides I've taken from FBI wanted posters. A good example was Claude Dallas. You probably remember him. He's the one who shot a couple of game wardens out west and then was able to live off the land for a considerable period of time. The mugshot shows him clean-shaven on one side and with the beard on the other, and all you have to do is to take one look to realize that this beard really hides nothing. The man is immediately recognizable. So facial hair, I don't think, is all that significant.
Facial identification seems to be one of the most basic way that human beings can identify one another. Yet there have been a number of studies done on the difficulties of interracial recognition. A Florida State University psychologist studied blacks and whites and found the problem affected each race about equally. Have you found this in your police work? And
absolutely. Absolutely. I have had many whites say to me, "All blacks look alike." I had blacks say to me, "All whites look alike."
What is going on here? And are you able to move beyond this in your interview with them to get information that's able to assist you?
Well, let's take that in order. Your first question was, what's going on here? And I think very probably the answer there is more in the realm of psychology than it is in the realm of forensic art. And I'd hesitate to try to answer that because I would be intruding on somebody else's territory. The other part of the question is, yes, you can say, "Now, hey, wait a minute, fella. Let's take a look at these two white men across the room. Do they look alike?" Well, no. Well, now, what are some of the differences? And then when you start pinpointing that, you get them to grin, and then they say, well, yes, maybe I do remember the shape of his head, or I do remember that he had an unusual nose, or I remember that he had a missing front tooth, or that his face was out of balance, or whatever it happens to be, you see. So I think once you get beyond that, I think it's something of a mental block. Oh, we hate to acknowledge it, of course, but it does exist. There's an awful lot of race prejudice around on both sides, and I think this is part of the problem. People are not really willing to attempt to describe something that they stand either in awe of or in fear of.
Have computers or the ability to digitize images and to change them with a light pen on a screen and to call up banks of images made your work more kind of a skill and handcraft that's no longer needed?
No, it hasn't, as a matter of fact, because no matter whether you have the most skillful artist in the world or whether you have the most sophisticated computer, you are still locked into a couple of factors that are invariable. And chief among those is the witness's memory.
Do police carry around photographs of suspects?
Some police do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Some police, as a matter of fact, keep a file of those inside their police hats.
So they've got it right at the top of their head. They can just
right. Exactly.
Take it up and look at it.
Exactly.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in, Douglas Henkel. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Douglas Henkel, author of Faces of Crime, published by Peachtree. This is Fresh Air. Later here on National Public Radio is today's edition of All Things Considered. Host Robert Siegel is here. Welcome.
Hello, Sedge. Today we'll be hearing about Mikhail Gorbachev's visit to Vilnius, the capital of the Soviet Republic of Lithuania, where the local party has broken with the Soviet Communist Party, and where the cause of Lithuanian independence is very popular. We'll hear about a dramatic exchange between Gorbachev and the leader of Lithuania's communists, in which the Soviet leader told him, like it or not, you're part of the Soviet Union. We'll also be hearing about the program of systematization. It meant destroying entire villages in Romania. It's a story that Noah Adams has brought back from his trip to that country. And also a talk with the emigre Russian writer Andrei Sinyavsky.
Startling stories on All Things Considered later here on National Public Radio. Comic Richard Lewis is always complaining about his health, whining about his looks, and kvetching about his ability to get a date. But there are a few complaints about his work this year. Our critic Laurie Stone has seen him recently, and she's a fan.
Richard Lewis is vaulting. Anything But Love, the sitcom on which he currently co-stars with Jamie Lee Curtis, is a wonderfully offbeat study in ambivalence. His HBO special, I'm Exhausted, was nominated for an ACE last year. And on December 27th, Lewis fulfilled a lifelong dream to play Carnegie Hall. Despite his trademark insecurity, at age 42, he's never been worthier of success. Lewis is a high-wire comedian who works without the safety net of a theatrical persona. He remains trained on his own psyche, which may be why he gained a following during the 80s, that leveraged buyout decade of individual gain run amok and traditionalism hawked as radical dissent. True yup comics like David Letterman and Dennis Miller are flustered by unsightly surfaces, difference, compulsions. They ridicule Kmart shoppers, people with Asian accents, fat guys. But oddness warms Lewis. Little about him is in control. He's overwhelmed, stooped, anxious. On stage, he paces like a zoo animal, grievances and wordplays flying from his lips. Fingers ritually flip to temples, and his neck inclines towards the floor.
I was in the Jewish Center League, which was unbelievable. You know, the refrigerators here in Chicago, I was the humidifier. That's all I know. I felt like the humidifier. I would, like, run excuses in from the sideline, you know. And, you know, It's Jewish Center League. One championship game, both teams claim defeat at the end of the game, you know? And the cheerleaders, the shroudheads, they would go, beat ourselves, beat ourselves. You know? And halftime, we have a kick, putt, and mourn contest at halftime.
The posture is secular davening, where self-disclosure substitutes for prayer. He's frank about subjects males usually find difficult to articulate. This quality heats his shots on Letterman because he so dramatically counterpoints the host's repression. Lewis describes real hypochondriacal bouts and his reflexive tendency to fall for rejecting women. Letterman, whose ironic commentary about being a TV host is devoid of self-knowledge, tolerates the candor because Lewis doesn't extract it from him. Lewis's role on Anything But Love may yield his best work yet. He's cannier and sexier here than on the stand-up stage, and his romance with Jamie Lee Curtis revs on the eroticism of androgynous pairing. Lewis, with his flowing tresses and plush wardrobe, is a soft-edged man. Curtis is angular and boyish, and they both have the same strong chin. The show exploits the sexual charge of a shared sense of irony. The couple's ability to act silly and admit similar ancient fears generates grown-up humor. Characters speak freely about kinks and body functions, about handcuffs and sleep drool. A few weeks ago, I talked to Lewis about his career, and though it was clear that doubts still shroud him, he's never been in better shape. He worries that his work is self-indulgent, but every so often he sees he's touching chords. Recently, a bunch of rosy-cheeked, contented-looking UCLA kids paraded by his car and shouted, "We're in pain, too!" It made him very happy. The uncommon, salutary message of his act is, life isn't supposed to be great all the time.
And I had a day that didn't work out. I'm lying in bed, you know, in Vegas, they have these mirrors everywhere, you know, and I was undressed, and which is one of my goals this year, to just be undressed when I make love, which is out of a call, and I saw the view of my body from God, which is the most frightening thing. If you don't work out, I look like Flipper. I look like Flipper. I can't believe this. You know, and I have roles. We all have people. If you work out, fine. But if you're born with roles, because I was in an incubator, I was born in an incubator. I wasn't born in an incubator. That would have been a little frightening. But I was an inch and a half by two, and I never forget it because I know my friends.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic, and is a contributor to the Village Voice. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, who also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Bob Alls. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Sedge Thompson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Polish filmmaker Jerzy Skolimowski. You may have seen his movie Moonlighting and seen him as the KGB agent in the film White Nights. He's directed a new movie, Torrents of Spring, starring Timothy Hutton and Nastasia Kinski. And that's just a taste of what we'll hear next time on Fresh Air.